Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Take a walk in somebody else's shoes with podcasts from the BBC World Service. Unmissable stories from around the globe. Search for the documentary Lives Less Ordinary and Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Are you ready for some magic?
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nigel Adderley, and at 1400 GMT on Friday the 5th of January, these are our main stories. Israel proposes a post-war plan for Gaza, as UN aid agencies say their efforts to deliver aid in the region are being hindered by security risks and checkpoint delays. North and South Korea have conducted live fire drills near their maritime border in the latest escalation of tensions. Also in this podcast, the release of Oscar Pistorius on parole 11 years after killing his girlfriend divides opinion in South Africa. And
the fact is, democracy needs journalism, and today journalism needs investment. And that's what we're here to provide.
A UAE-backed bid for one of Britain's most influential newspapers causes controversy. The United Nations has responded to criticism from Israel that it's not delivering aid quickly enough to Gaza, despite Israel opening new crossings into the territory. In a statement, the UN's Office for Humanitarian Affairs said agencies continued to do all they could in the face of multiple challenges, including denial of access and constant bombardment. Imogen Folks reports from Geneva.
Earlier this week, Israel said the UN was stalling over aid deliveries to Gaza, suggesting Israel was playing its part, but UN aid agencies were not. Now the UN has responded, saying its teams are hampered by long inspections, multiple checkpoints, and constant bombardment, with aid workers being shot at and even killed. Last night, the UN reported it had been unable to deliver vital food and medicines to northern Gaza for 4 days because it had been denied access and because of active conflict. The UN statement reflects growing aid agency frustration at what many see as a perhaps willful misinterpretation by Israel of the risks and logistics of delivering aid inside a conflict zone.
Meanwhile, the Israeli Defence Minister, Yoav Gallant, has unveiled his vision for the future of post-war Gaza. Crucially, he emphasised that while Palestinians would have administrative authority, Israel would maintain overarching security control. The minister's broad outline was unveiled as US Secretary of State Antony Blinken embarks on his fourth trip to the region since the Hamas attack in October triggered the war. Our correspondent Shaima Khalil is in the occupied West Bank. She says the Israeli plan leaves many questions unanswered, particularly what the future holds for those people of Gaza displaced by the war.
Well, first of all, there isn't much of a mention of the people, and I think that in itself would be problematic for any of the negotiators, especially the two key Arab negotiators, Egypt and Qatar. But secondly, I think one of the biggest problematic points was the mention of Israel being responsible for the security in Gaza for some time. I think that's going to make any diplomacy a problem. I think the other problem is the fact that it's not very clear which Palestinian factions, which Palestinian figures would be in charge of Gaza. We know that the United States, for example, wants the Palestinian Authority to take part. That really hasn't gone down well in Israel. But also remember that just before the killing of Saleh al-Aruri, there was a statement from Hamas where they say that they've told Egypt, reportedly, that any planning of the future of Gaza without Hamas is an illusion. So these suggestions are significant in terms of the problems that they're going to present diplomatic efforts and negotiating efforts with the United States, but also with Egypt and Qatar, the chief negotiators.
And of course, the US's top diplomat, Antony Blinken, is heading into the region later today. Has his job become much more difficult as a result of what's happened this week?
I think so. I think he has a lot to untangle. There is still a very deep concern about any retaliation from Hamas and potentially from Hezbollah. The speech by Hassan Nasrallah, I think, allayed fears initially that there was going to be an all-out confrontation and conflict with Israel. He hasn't said that, but he also said that this is not going to go without punishment. But remember also this week, we've had inflammatory statements, at least that's the way they were described by the U.S. State Department, by two Israeli cabinet ministers, the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, and the national security minister, Ben-Gavir, who were both calling for the Gazans to leave, for people of Gaza to leave. And I think Anthony Blinken is going to have to untangle a lot of that, plus, of course, the plan that has been presented by the Israeli government. Remember also Egypt in that plan has an unspecified role. And I think that also is going to not go down well with Cairo. They've been chief negotiators. I don't think they want to be pulled in into anything else in terms of administration. And so again, this plan has presented a lot of questions for diplomatic efforts.
Shaima Khalil. The Korean Peninsula is volatile at the best of times. The North and South remain technically at war, even though an armistice was signed in 1953. And today the tension was taken up a few more notches, as North Korean forces fired hundreds of artillery shells into the sea off two tiny South Korean islands, and Seoul responded with live fire drills on one of them. This was the reaction of some residents of the South Korean capital.
I do think about preparations, as the war isn't completely over yet, but I think it will be settled well somehow. There may be minor clashes, but I believe it will not become a big war.
I think people certainly have to be informed of the reason why we have to evacuate and how and where to evacuate to, since we do not generally know where the evacuation shelters or bunkers are.
Our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton has been following the day's events.
North Korea fired shells. They fired about 200 artillery shells into waters still on the North Korean side of a maritime line. But South Korea felt threatened by this. And so they've reacted by ordering Marines to carry out live fire artillery drills on one of three quite remote islands near that important line where those original shells were fired. South Korea says it's also planning to stage some of its own naval drills. Now, the important thing is that it's not that unusual for North Korea to carry out this kind of artillery shell drill on its side of this quite sensitive maritime line. It's just that this is taking place quite soon after the two Koreas decided to scrap an inter-Korea military agreement that had been in place for 5 years, that had been keeping tensions relatively low. Tensions are rising now. That agreement to keep peace has been scrapped. And so that's why both countries are feeling quite tense and quite nervous right now.
And you've been to one of the islands involved, and just how sensitive is this area?
That's right. So I went to the island where the live fire drills are taking place right now, Yongpyeon, back in 2010. That's when North Korea fired shells that actually landed on the island, killing four people, including two civilians. So I traveled out to that island to do some reporting. I've got to say, it was a very ruggedly beautiful, quite remote part of the world, but it didn't take us very long at all to find shelters where civilians have to seek refuge when there are military tensions, when shells are fired. And so that's just a way of life on that island. And it's quite normal for residents there to have to think about that because they're so close to this very sensitive maritime line.
Celia Hatton, as you may have heard in the earlier podcast, the South African former Paralympic champion Oscar Pistorius has been released from prison on parole after serving 8.5 years for the murder of his girlfriend, Reeva Steenkamp. His parole demands that he doesn't speak to the press, so his release was carried out with little fanfare, despite the hordes of media surrounding the prison. Reeva Steenkamp's mother has said she isn't convinced he's rehabilitated, and his release could pose a threat to women. Bulewa Adonis is a spokesman for Women for Change, a non-profit organisation that campaigns against gender-based violence. She said Mr. Pistorius' release sent out the wrong message.
Oscar's release is an indication that we have a serious problem, that there's, a normalisation of leniency when it comes to predators, when it comes to anyone who commits any type of femicide or gender-based violence.
So, has justice been done? Karin Morn is a legal reporter in South Africa who covered the trial in 2014 and Pistorius's appeal.
In the South African legal system, and particularly under the correctional services legislation, inmates sentenced not for life become eligible for parole after they've served half their sentence. And having read the prison files and the prison reports that were given by the social worker, psychologist, unit manager, all the staff at the prison, they were overwhelmingly supportive of him getting parole. They describe him as someone who drove a tractor, cleaned up the prison cells, the special care unit, acted as a library administrator, offered weightlifting advice to fellow inmates, also running a Bible study, having a book club. You know, I've gone through the files. There were no disciplinary infractions. There was nothing suggestive of someone who was a threat to society, which of course is what parole authorities need to examine before they let someone out. And I think there's a fundamental difficulty because the public imagination is very much, as understandably, June Steenkamp and her late husband believed, that this was a GBV, a gender-based violence case. But that was not the ultimate finding of the Supreme Court of Appeal. But people very much perceive this continually as a gender-based crime. But the parole system, the prison system, will deal with him on the facts that were found by the court. And this is what the court found.
The belief is that he still insists he didn't do it deliberately and wants to tell his victim's parents that.
Yes. I mean, in the social worker and the psychologist report, you know, the social worker actually says that it is, quote unquote, killing him inside. This idea that he will never get the opportunity to apologize to them for killing Reeva Steenkamp. So he has maintained throughout that, you know, this was not a deliberate act. That is an explanation which Barry Steenkamp did not accept. June Steenkamp does not accept. She made that very clear in the victim offender statement that she submitted to the parole authorities, where she said, I fundamentally believe that this was an act of gender-based violence, and I fundamentally don't believe his version of events.
Karin Morn, a legal reporter in South Africa. The United States is sending military logistical support to aid areas in Japan that were badly hit by Monday's earthquake. 92 people are now known to have been killed by the quake, and more than 200 are still missing. Japan's Prime Minister says rescuers will continue to search for them. The BBC's James Copnell spoke to Musubi Yata from the Japanese Red Cross Society about the hope of finding those still missing after the crucial four-day mark had passed.
Yesterday, after the 72-hour mark, one woman, 80-something years age, in Ishikawa Prefecture, Wajima City, was rescued. We still have hope. The biggest challenge for us is the access. Most disastrous areas in Noto Peninsula, because of road cracks and landslides, it's quite difficult to reach. The major road to the Noto Peninsula were partially damaged because of the landslide, because it rained since 2 days ago. So landslide also happened. So this prevents us from getting in.
And is there a risk of aftershocks or landslides right now? Is it a dangerous rescue operation?
Yes, as of yesterday, January 4th, 499 aftershocks have been confirmed. When aftershocks happen, we have to stop some relief activities or medical activities. And because of the aftershocks, the road may collapse again. So these kind of things prevent us from continuing the relief activities.
Tell us about the people who have survived, thankfully, but maybe have lost their homes. What sort of conditions are they in?
Because they have no home right now. So the situation is now they have to stay at evacuation centers, which is no heat or no warm environment. Their needs is now food or water, blankets, very basic items, but still it's quite difficult to deliver this item to that area. They have to stay at evacuation centers or their own vehicles. And these kind of conditions may worsen their health condition. We try to deploy medical teams, but still it is not sufficient.
Musubi Yata from the Japanese Red Cross. Still to come, could AI serve as your virtual therapist?
So many people talk about it. They can access it when their thoughts get hard, like at 2 a.m., where they can't really talk to any other friends. People with mental health difficulties, oftentimes their thoughts will keep them up.
Who would kick off 14 of their best players to defend his race's dignity.
Unmissable stories from around the globe.
I get a call from the moral police. They told me the general wants to talk to you.
The army asked us to leave the house immediately because it was going to be bombed.
Podcasts from the BBC World Service. Search for Amazing Sports Stories, Lives Less Ordinary, and The Documentary, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The Abu Dhabi-backed investor bidding to buy one of Britain's most influential newspapers has promised journalists will be given total editorial freedom by its potential new owners. The proposed sale of the Daily and Sunday Telegraph has prompted concern about the papers falling under the control of a foreign autocratic state. Jeff Zucker, the former boss of CNN, is leading the bid by the investment firm Red Bird. He says any apprehension over the UAE-backed bid will be addressed by legally binding agreements with the government and also the UK regulator Ofcom. He spoke exclusively to the BBC's business editor, Simon Jack.
The reality is, when was the last time someone came along and invested in such a serious way in a British newspaper or a British magazine? The fact is, democracy needs journalism, and today journalism needs investment. And that's what we're here to provide.
You say journalism needs democracy. That's the last thing Abu Dhabi provides, is it not? I mean, IMI controls other media titles, The National, for example, a daily newspaper in English. For example, the story of Princess Latifah, member of the Dubai ruling family, fled Dubai in 2018, was forcibly returned. It was a big story in the Western press. The National didn't cover it at all. Are you seriously saying that journalists will be free to roam wherever they want, given the ownership?
I can guarantee that journalists will be free to roam wherever they want. There will be no involvement from IMI. That's underpinned in our guarantees to the UK government through Ofcom, that there will be complete and total editorial independence.
Just unpack those reassurances. What reassurances can you give? How's that going to work?
There's three levels of protection that are cast iron. One is a legally binding JV agreement that already exists between Redbird and IMI that confirms that IMI is a completely passive investor with no operating role whatsoever. But that is a private agreement. And so we have also undertaken a specific separate agreement with the UK government in which IMI has guaranteed that they will not be involved in any way in the operation of these titles. And then, most importantly, we have now committed to an editorial trust board that will ensure that all the terms of editorial independence are adhered to.
If the owners and 75% ownership will be with the Abu Dhabi royal family, they can appoint a board, they can dissolve it as well. It's a bit like a football team or soccer team, as you would say, that the owners can appoint the manager and they can also sack the manager and the management staff at any time.
No, Simon, in fact, we've committed that the editorial trust board will be determined solely by Redbird. And we've made that in a legally binding commitment to the UK government.
If you had diluted the Abu Dhabi royal family's investment so it was less than 50%, then you would have not a controlling interest and people would probably be a lot more confident. And yet that was rejected, we understand. Why was it rejected? And what does that tell us about this not being a financial investment, but one where you're buying influence and power, or the royal family are buying influence and power?
This is an American-led investment, led by Redbird. We are
funded by the UAE.
We are confident that our commitments and the incredibly robust, legally underpinned editorial protections that we have submitted to Ofcom will be sufficient to address any concerns.
Jeff Zucker speaking to the BBC's Simon Jack. New uses of artificial intelligence are coming out all the time, but one that few predicted appears to be taking off with young people: AI therapy. A user-made psychologist has received millions of messages from predominantly young users. The chatbot has been sent 78 million messages from people, 18 million of which have been sent since November and over the holiday period. Some say it's a positive new way for young people to get mental health help. But some human psychologists fear the chatbots aren't qualified or effective. The BBC cyber correspondent Joe Tidy reports.
Beyonce.
It's me, Mario.
Super Mario.
I'm not the CEO of Twitter. My dog is the CEO of Twitter.
Okay. Elon Musk.
Russia.
And Vladimir Putin. You can chat to an AI version of pretty much anyone on character.ai. The platform uses artificial intelligence, similar to that of ChatGPT, to allow users to create chatbots that pretend to be any fictional or real people or characters and have text conversations. But there's one character that's way more popular than all those we just heard from, a psychologist. 78 million messages have been shared with the bot since it was created by a user called Blazeman98 just over a year ago. In the lead-up to Christmas and over the festive season, 18 million messages were shared with the character, which, according to its bio, is someone who helps with life's difficulties. Blazeman98 says he's stunned by how popular it's proving.
I was having my mid-school exams, and I was quite stressed, and all my friends were quite stressed. And I was also at the time looking for something to talk to, because I was like, oh, all my friends are busy. And so I tried my hand at making something, never intended it for it to become popular. And then I jumped back on it. Then I was getting like a lot of messages from people saying that they had been really positively affected by it, utilizing it well. You know, this was a source of comfort for them.
Blazeman98 is actually Sam Zia, a postgrad psychology student in New Zealand. He's been so surprised by the impact his bot's having, he's now researching why people are turning to AI for therapy, especially young people. Character AI has about 3.5 million users a day from around the world, chatting to bots in multiple languages, and the site's dominated by the under-30s.
I wouldn't be surprised, obviously this is not validated by research, but I wouldn't be surprised if text, like messaging, is the preferred and common form of communication. You know, picking up the phone or having a face-to-face conversation is more difficult generally. But for some people, they might find the AI easier to use. So many people talk about it being free and they can access it when their thoughts get hard, like at 2 a.m., where they can't really talk to any other friends or they can't talk to a real therapist. But like people with mental health difficulties, oftentimes their thoughts will keep them up.
We asked some human therapists to try it out, and they all agreed it's probably an inevitable trend as demand for mental health help grows. But they all questioned how effective bots like this are, as they can't pick up on the cues that people can over video calls or in person. The San Francisco company says it's pleased that people are finding support through its bots, but urges users to seek professional and certified help. The firm also played down the popularity of therapy on its platform, pointing out that anime and computer game characters are more popular and used for fun and role-playing. But we counted nearly 500 character bots based around therapy, some like Are You Feeling OK? And another claiming to be a licensed clinical professional counsellor have been sent more than 10 million messages each. There are other bespoke AI therapy apps out there too that are growing in popularity, but it seems that character AI is proving to be an unlikely frontier for this new use of artificial intelligence.
Joe Tidy. There are fears for the future of Africa's birds of prey, as a study warns of potential widespread population collapse. The study's authors say urgent action is needed, with nearly 90% of species facing steep declines outside protected areas. They're calling for energy and agricultural companies to put biodiversity first. The study's author, Dr. Darcy Ogada, spoke from Kenya to the BBC's Victoria Owankunda.
The declines were largest in the region of West Africa, and that is an area where we know the agricultural production has been extremely fast and rapid over the last few decades, and also the human population growth there as well. And so, yeah, we did find that populations of raptors, both inside and outside of protected areas, our parks and reserves, did fall the greatest in West Africa, but they've declined generally across the whole continent.
Looking at these birds of prey, I wonder what role they play in the ecological system.
Yeah, they play a really important role. I think you need to think about raptors as our big predators in the sky. Just like lions and hyenas are here on the ground, we have the same up in the air. So these are the species that are controlling prey populations, things like insects, small birds, rodents in your agricultural farms. So these are populations that control those prey populations. And we've seen in other areas across the globe where when you lose the top predators, you basically have a whole cascade of effects on the ecosystem and everything that exists below these top predators.
Dr. Darcy Ogada. The most distant planets in our solar system, Neptune and Uranus, share surprising similarities in their colours, which have been revealed by new images. Neptune was previously widely believed to have been a vibrant blue, while Uranus was thought to be more green. However, a study conducted by scientists from the University of Oxford suggests both planets are a comparable shade of greenish-blue. So why did we previously think they had different colours? Here's our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
It's a little bit of an accident of history, I guess, Nigel, is what you would say. So these images that we've all kind of become accustomed to were delivered to us by the Voyager 2 spacecraft, this fantastic space probe that's still going. It's about a 20 billion kilometre journey so far beyond our solar system. But it went past these ice giants, as scientists call them, back in the late 1980s, sent back pictures with cameras that were 1960s, 1970s technology. And they interpreted the colours, the filters that they used at the time. And they gave us pictures, close-up pictures of these planets for the very first time. And in the case of Neptune, which has got this sort of rather gaudy blue colour that we've become used to, NASA, in their caption that they released with that image, did say that they'd stretched the colours to enhance certain features, like, you know, clouds, the bands in the atmosphere. But that's kind of been lost over time. We've become used to this bluish interpretation of Neptune. But of course, you know, newer technology comes along. We've got great telescopes now, and they've been able to revisit those pictures and give us a truer view of what the planets look like.
And beyond the colour similarity, what else did we learn about these planets?
Well, Uranus is quite interesting. Uranus actually changes its colour as viewed from Earth as it goes around the sun. It takes a long time. Uranus is really odd because it's kind of like on its side. It rotates on its side, and that makes it put its poles towards the sun. And as it does that, then it modifies its green color through time. But you shouldn't really be surprised to see scientists interpreting colors the way that they do. I mean, a good example is we've had a brand new picture of Uranus from the James Webb Space Telescope recently. Now, James Webb detects infrared light. You and I can't see infrared light, so they have to interpret those images that come down, adding colour to those images that come down. You know, James Webb, when it looks at Uranus and sees its fabulous rings, it has rings, it looks like a gaudy dartboard, if I can put it that way. You wouldn't see that if you were there. But we need these different ways of looking at objects in space to enable us to interpret what we're seeing. And in the case of James Webb and Uranus, it's about seeing those 13 rings that the planet has, which in the Voyager image of Uranus you don't see because they're quite diffuse.
Jonathan Amos. In a career that lasted over six decades, Glynis Johns appeared in more than 60 films. The British actor, who died in Los Angeles at the age of 100, was best known for playing the suffragette mother Winifred Banks in Mary Poppins. She starred alongside Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke in the 1964 musical. Later, on Broadway, Glynis Johns sang Send in the Clowns, which was written by one of America's greatest composers and lyricists, Stephen Sondheim. As Vincent Dowd reports, her first big screen role came in the 1948 comedy Miranda.
You know a lot about music.
No, practically nothing.
I have rather a nice voice, you know. Glynis Johns was born into an acting family. Her first film was in 1938. A decade later, her sexy performance as a mermaid in Miranda made her a star in Britain. The first Hollywood movie was The Court Jester with Danny Kaye. On stage and screen, reviewers almost always noted her slightly unusual husky voice.
I don't think I have a typically English voice. I played quite a few American roles in America and just softened the A's a little bit, and I get away with it.
Glynis Johns had already made a couple of films for Disney when, in 1964, they cast her as the suffragette mother in one of their all-time hits, Mary Poppins.
So cast off the shackles of yesterday and shoulder to shoulder into the fray. Our daughter's daughters will adore us.
But her career highlight was her return to the Broadway stage in 1973. In A Little Night Music, Stephen Sondheim wrote for Johns what became his biggest song.
Isn't it rich? Isn't it queer?
As a singer, Glynis Johns had limited technique, but Stephen Sondheim knew her distinctive vocal delivery would give Sendin the Clowns the poignancy the moment called for. On stage.
There ought to be clowns. Well, maybe next year.
Vincent Dowd on the life of Glynis Johns. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. And tomorrow, Jackie Leonard will also have another Happy Pod.
Yes, in this week's edition, the detective work of a photographer in Pakistan that reunited a British artist with her lost portfolio. From Australia, the parents who powered their son's dialysis machine with their electric car when terrible storms took out their electricity supply. The Hawaiian jewellers restoring precious possessions left charred by last year's wildfires on Maui. And a new sports star, Luke the Nuke, the teenager who has captured world attention and brought a whole new audience to darts. All on this week's edition of the Happy Pod, available from Saturday the 6th of January.
If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Annie Smith, and the producer was Marion Strawn. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nigel Adderley. Until next time, goodbye.
Where do I see myself in 5 years? I want to buy a camper van with a sweet solar-powered kitchenette. And space for my best friend, too. Yes, you.
Let's get started on your 5-year plan. CIBC, ambitions made real.